Time Warner Audiobooks presents The Tenth Insight, Holding the Vision, Further Adventures of the Celestine Prophecy, written and with an introduction by James Redfield, read by Blair Underwood.
Hello, I'm James Redfield. Like The Celestine Prophecy, this sequel is an adventure parable, an attempt to illustrate the ongoing spiritual transformation that is occurring in our time. My hope with both books has been to communicate what I would call a consensus picture of the new perceptions, feelings, and phenomena that are coming to define life as we enter the third millennium. Our greatest mistake, in my opinion, is to think that human spirituality is somehow already understood and established. If history tells us anything, it is that human culture and knowledge are constantly evolving. Only individual opinions are fixed and dogmatic. Truth is more dynamic than that. And the great joy of life is in letting go, in finding our own special truth that is ours to tell, and then watching the synchronistic way this truth evolves and takes a clear form, just when it's needed to make an impact on someone's life. Together we are going somewhere. Each generation building upon the accomplishments of the previous one, destined for an end we can only dimly remember. We're all in the process of awakening and opening up to who we really are and what we came here to do, which is often a very difficult task. Yet I firmly believe that if we always integrate the best of the traditions we find before us and keep the process in mind, each challenge along the way, each interpersonal irritation, can be overcome with a sense of destiny and miracle. I don't mean to minimize the formidable problems still facing humanity, only to suggest that each of us in our own way is involved in the solution. If we stay aware and acknowledge the great mystery that is this life, we will see that we have been perfectly placed in exactly the right position to make all the difference in the world.
I walked out to the edge of the granite overhang and looked northward at the scene below. Stretching across my view was a large Appalachian valley of striking beauty, perhaps 6 or 7 miles long and 5 miles wide. Along the length of the valley ran a winding stream that coursed through stretches of open meadowland and thick, colorful forests. Old forests, with trees standing hundreds of feet high. I glanced down at the crude map in my hand. Everything in the valley coincided with the drawing exactly. The steep ridge on which I was standing. The road leading down. The description of the landscape and the stream. The rolling foothills beyond. This had to be the place Charlene had sketched on the note found in her office. Why had she done that? And why had she suddenly disappeared? Over a month had now passed since Charlene had last contacted her associates at the research firm where she worked. And by the time Frank Carter, her office mate, had thought to call me, he had become clearly alarmed. "She often goes off on her own tangents," he had said. "But she's never disappeared for this long before, and never when she had meetings already set with long-term clients. Something's not right." "How did you know to call me?" I asked. He responded by describing part of a letter, found in Charlene's office, that I had written to her months earlier chronicling my experiences in Peru. With it, he told me, was a scribbled note that contained my name and telephone number. "I'm calling everyone I know who's associated with her," he added. "So far, no one seems to know a thing. I was hoping you had heard from her." "Sorry," I told him. "I haven't talked to her in 4 months." Even as I had said the words, I couldn't believe it had been that long. Soon after receiving my letter, Charlene had telephoned and left a long message on my answering machine. voicing her excitement about the insights and commenting on the speed with which knowledge of them seemed to be spreading. I remembered listening to Charlene's message several times, but I put off calling her back. I knew at the time that speaking with her would put me in the position of having to recall and explain the details of the manuscript. And I told myself I needed more time to think, to digest what had occurred. The truth, of course, was that parts of the prophecy still eluded me. Certainly I had retained the ability to connect with the spiritual energy within, a great comfort to me considering that everything had fallen through with Marjorie. And I was now spending large amounts of time alone. And I was more aware than ever of intuitive thoughts and dreams and the luminosity of a room or landscape. Yet at the same time, the sporadic nature of the coincidences had become a problem. I would fill up with energy, for instance, discerning the question foremost in my life, and would usually perceive a clear hunch about what to do or where to go to pursue the answer. Yet, after acting accordingly, too often nothing of importance would occur. I would find no message, no coincidence. Such failure had not soured me on the process, but I had realized something was missing when it came to living the insights long term. In Peru, I had been proceeding on momentum, often acting spontaneously with a kind of faith born out of desperation. When I arrived back home, though, dealing again with my normal environment, often surrounded by outright skeptics, I seemed to lose the keen expectation or firm belief that my hunches were really going to lead somewhere. Apparently there was some vital part of the knowledge I had forgotten, or perhaps not yet discovered. "I'm just not sure what to do next," Charlene's associate pressed. "She has a sister, I think, somewhere in New York. You don't know how to contact her, do you? Or anyone else who might know where she is?" "I'm sorry," I said, "I don't. Charlene and I are actually rekindling an old friendship. I don't remember any relatives, and I don't know who her friends are now." "Well, I think I'm going to file a police report unless you have a better idea." "No, I think that would be wise. Are there any other leads?" "Only a drawing of some kind. Could be a description of a place. It's hard to tell." Later, he faxed me the entire note he had found in Charlene's office, including the crude sketch of intersecting lines and numbers with vague marks in the margins. And as I had sat in my study comparing the drawing to the road numbers in an atlas of the South, I had found what I suspected to be the actual location. Afterwards, I had experienced a vivid image of Charlene in my mind, the same image I perceived in Peru when told of the existence of a tenth insight. Was her disappearance somehow connected to the manuscript? A wisp of wind touched my face, and I again studied the view below. Far to the left, at the western edge of the valley, I could make out a row of rooftops. That had to be the town Charlene had indicated on the map. Stuffing the paper into my vest pocket, I made my way back to the road and climbed into the Pathfinder. The town itself was small, population 2,000 according to the sign beside the first and only stoplight. Most of the commercial buildings lined just one street running along the edge of the stream. I drove through the light, spotted a motel near the entrance to the National Forest, and pulled into a parking space facing an adjacent restaurant and pub. Several people were entering the door, including a tall man with a dark complexion and jet black hair, carrying a large pack. He glanced back at me, and we momentarily made eye contact. I got out and locked the car, then decided on a hunch to walk through the restaurant before checking into the motel. Inside, the tables were nearly empty, just a few hikers at the bar and some of the people who had entered ahead of me in a booth. Most were oblivious to my gaze, but as I continued to survey the room, I again met eyes with the tall man I had seen before. He was walking out a back exit. I followed him through the exit. He was dressed in jeans, a western shirt and boots, and appeared to be about 50 years old. Behind him, the late afternoon sun cast long shadows among the tall trees and grass, and 50 yards away, the stream flowed by, beginning its journey into the valley. He smiled half-heartedly and looked up at me. "Another pilgrim?" he asked. "I'm looking for a friend," I said. "I had a hunch that you could help me." He nodded, studying the outlines of my body very carefully. He introduced himself as David Lone Eagle, explaining, as though it was something I might need to know, that he was a direct descendant of the Native Americans who originally inhabited this valley. "You want some coffee?" he asked. He nodded toward an area near the stream where a small tent stood among three large poplars. Dozens of people were walking in the area, some of them along a path that crossed a bridge and led into the National Forest. Everything appeared safe. "Sure," I replied. "That would be good." At the campsite, he lit a small butane camp stove, then filled a boiler with water and set it upon the burner. "What's your friend's name?" he finally asked. "Charlene Billings." He paused and looked at me, and as we gazed at each other, I saw a clear image in my mind's eye of him in another time. He was younger and dressed in buckskins, sitting in front of a large fire. Streaks of war paint adorned his face. Around him were gathered a circle of people, mostly Native Americans, but including two whites, a woman and a very large man. The discussion was heated. Some in the group wanted war. Others desired reconciliation. He broke in, ridiculing the ones considering peace. How could they be so naive, he told them, after so much treachery? The white woman seemed to understand, but pleaded with him to hear her out. War could be avoided, she maintained, and the valley protected fairly, if the spiritual medicine was great enough. He rebuked her argument totally. Then, chiding the group, he mounted his horse and rode away. Most of the others followed. "Your instincts are good," David said, snapping me from my vision. He was spreading a hand-sewn blanket between us, offering me a seat. "I've heard of her." "I'm concerned," I said. "No one has heard from her, and I just wanted to make sure she's okay." "Then we need to talk." "About the tenth insight?" he asked, smiling.
"How did you know that?"
"Just a guess. Many of the people coming to this valley are here to talk about the insights. They think the tenth is somewhere out there. A few even claim to know what it says." He turned away and put a tea ball filled with coffee into the steaming water. Something about his tone of voice made me think he was testing me, trying to check out whether I was who I claimed. "Where is Charlene?" I asked. He pointed a finger toward the east.
"In the forest. I've never met your friend, but I overheard her being introduced in the restaurant one night. Several days ago, I saw her again. She was hiking into the valley alone, and judging from the way she was packed, I'd say she's probably still out there."
I looked in that direction. From this perspective, the valley looked enormous, stretching forever into the distance. "Where do you think she was going?" I asked. He stared at me for a moment.
"Probably toward the Sipsey Canyon. That's where one of the openings was found."
"The openings?"
He smiled cryptically. "That's right. The dimensional openings."
I leaned over toward him, remembering my experience at the Celestine Ruins. "Who knows about all this?"
"Very few people. So far, it's all rumor, bits and pieces of information, intuition. Not a soul has seen a manuscript. Most of the people who come here looking for the tenth feel they're being synchronistically led, and they're genuinely trying to live the nine insights, even though they complain that the coincidences guide them along for a while and then just stop."
He chuckled lightly.
"But that's where we all are, right? The tenth insight is about understanding this whole business, the perception of mysterious coincidences, Earth's growing spiritual consciousness, the ninth insight disappearances, all from the higher perspective of the other dimension, so that we can understand why it is all happening and participate more fully."
He reached over and poured the coffee into two cups and handed one to me.
"My ancestors have lived near this valley for thousands of years," he continued. "They believe this forest was a sacred site midway between the upper world and the middle world here on Earth. My people would fast and enter the valley on their vision quests, looking for their specific gifts, their medicine, the path they should walk in this life. My grandfather told me about a shaman who came from a faraway tribe and taught our people to search for what he called a state of purification. The shaman taught them to leave from this very spot bearing only a knife and to walk until the animals provided a sign, and then to follow until they reached what they called the sacred opening into the upper world. If they were worthy, if they had cleared the lower emotions, he told them, they may even be allowed to enter the opening and to meet directly with the ancestors, where they could remember not only their own visions, but the vision of the whole world. Of course, that all ended when the white man came. My grandfather couldn't remember how to do it, and neither can I. We're having to figure it out like everyone else. He looked away momentarily, then said, my problem is that I want the past 3 centuries to have happened differently. I resent the fact that Europeans began to settle on this continent with no regard for the people who were already here. It was criminal. I want it to have happened differently, as though I could somehow change the past. Our way of life was important. We were learning the value of remembering. This was the great message the Europeans could have received from my people if they had stopped to listen. As he talked, my mind drifted into another daydream. 2 people, another Native American and the same white woman, were walking on the banks of a small stream. Behind them was a thick forest. After a while, other Native Americans crowded around to hear their conversation. We can heal this, the woman was saying. I'm afraid we don't know enough yet, the Native American replied, his face expressing great regard for the woman. Most of the other chiefs have already left. Why not? Think of the discussions we've had. You yourself said if there was enough faith, we could heal this. Yes, he replied. But faith is a certainty that comes from knowing how things should be. The ancestors know, but not enough of us here have reached that knowing. My thoughts were interrupted by the sight of several young Forest Service officers who were approaching an older man on the bridge. He had neatly cut gray hair and wore dress slacks and a starched shirt. As he moved, he seemed to limp slightly. You see the man with the officers? David asked. Yeah, I replied. What about him? I've seen him around here for the past 2 weeks. His name is Feynman, I think. David leaned toward me, sounding for the first time as if he trusted me completely. Listen, something very strange is going on. For several weeks, the Forest Service seems to have been counting the hikers who go into the forest. They've never done that before. And yesterday, someone told me they have completely closed off the far eastern end of the wilderness. There are places in that area that are 10 miles from the nearest highway. Do you know how few people ever venture out that far? Some of us have begun to hear strange noises in that direction. What kind of noises? A dissonance of some kind. Most people can't hear it. Suddenly, he was up on his feet, quickly taking down his tent. What are you doing? I asked. I can't stay here, he replied. I've got to get into the valley. After a moment, he interrupted his work and looked at me again. Listen, he said. There's something you have to know. That man I pointed out to you, Feynman, I saw your friend with him several times. What were they doing? Just talking. But I'm telling you, there's something wrong here. He began packing again. I watched him in silence for a moment. I had no idea what to think about this situation, but I sensed that he was right about Charlene being somewhere out in the valley. Let me get my equipment, I said. I'd like to go with you. No, he said quickly. Each person must experience the valley alone. I can't help you now. It's my own vision I must find. His face looked pained. Can you tell me exactly where this canyon is? Just follow the stream for about 2 miles. You'll come to another small creek that enters the stream from the north. Follow this creek for another mile. It will lead you right through the mouth of the Sipsey Canyon. I nodded and turned to walk away, but he grabbed my arm. Look, he said, you can find your friend if you raise your energy to another level. There are specific locations in the valley that can help you. The dimensional openings? I asked. Yes. There you can discover the perspective of the 10th insight. But to find these places, you must understand the true nature of your intuitions and how to maintain these mental images. Also, watch the animals, and you'll begin to remember what you are doing here in this valley, why we're all here together. But be very careful. Don't let them see you enter the forest. He thought for a moment. There's someone else out there, a friend of mine, Curtis Weber. Now, if you see Curtis, tell him that you've talked to me, and that I will find him. He smiled faintly and returned to folding his tent. I wanted to ask what he meant about intuition and watching the animals, but he avoided eye contact and stayed focused on his work. Thanks, I said. He waved slightly with one hand. I quietly shut the motel door and eased out into the moonlight. The cool air and the tension sent a shiver through my body. Why, I thought, was I doing this? There was no proof that Charlene was still out in this valley, or that David's suspicions were correct, for that matter. Yet my gut told me that, indeed, something was wrong. For several hours, I had mulled over calling the local sheriff. But what would I have said? That my friend was missing, and that she had been seen entering the forest of her own free will, but was perhaps in trouble, all based on a vague note found hundreds of miles away? Searching this wilderness would take hundreds of people, and I knew that they would never mount such an effort without something more substantial. I paused and looked at the three-quarters moon rising above the trees. My plan was to cross the stream well east of the ranger station, and then to proceed along the main path into the valley. I was counting on the moon to light my way, but not to be this bright. Visibility was at least 100 yards. I made my way past the edge of the pub to the area where David had camped. The site was completely clean. He had even spread leaves and pine straw to remove any sign of his presence. To cross where I had planned, I would have to walk about 40 yards in plain sight of the ranger station, which I could now see clearly. Crouching low, I pulled my pack up on my shoulders, walked out onto the sandy floodwash that bordered the stream, and finally into the water itself, sloshing through mounds of smooth river stone and stepping over several decayed logs. At its deepest point, the moderately swift water reached my upper thigh, but in seconds I had moved across the 30 feet of current and into a stand of small pines. I carefully moved forward until I found the hiking path leading into the valley. I walked over a half mile into the forest before making my way, well off the path, into a heavily wooded area to raise the tent and spend the night, glad to take off my wet boots and let them dry. It would be smarter to proceed in the daylight. I awoke at dawn thinking about David's cryptic remark about maintaining my intuitions, and as I lay in my sleeping bag, I reviewed my own understanding of the seventh insight, particularly the awareness that the experience of synchronicity follows a certain structure. According to this insight, each of us, once we work to clear our past dramas, can identify certain questions that define our particular life situation. Questions related to our careers, relationships, where we should live, how we should proceed on our path. Then, if we remain aware, gut feelings, hunches, intuitions would provide impressions of where to go, what to do, with whom we should speak, in order to pursue and answer. After that, of course, a coincidence was supposed to occur, revealing the reason we were urged to follow such a course, and providing new information that pertained in some way to our question, leading us forward in our lives. How would maintaining the intuition help? Easing out of my sleeping bag, I pulled the tent flap apart and checked outside. Sensing nothing unusual, I climbed out into the crisp fall air and walked back to the stream where I washed my face in the cool water. Afterward, I packed up and headed east again, nibbling on a granola bar and keeping myself hidden as much as possible in the tall trees that bordered the stream. After traveling perhaps 3 miles, a perceptible wave of fear and nervousness passed through my body, and I immediately felt fatigued. So I sat down and leaned against a tree, attempting to focus on my surroundings and gain inner energy. I noticed a small green plant with yellow blossoms about 10 feet away and focused on its beauty. Already draped in full sunlight, it seemed brighter suddenly, its leaves a richer green. A rush of fragrance reached my awareness, along with the musty smell of leaves and black soil. Simultaneously, from the trees, far toward the north, I heard the call of several crows. The richness of the sound amazed me. As I concentrated on listening, I became fully aware of dozens of other individual sounds that made up the morning chorus. Songbirds in the trees above me, a bumblebee among the wild daisies at the edge of the stream, the water gurgling around the rocks and fallen branches, and then something else, barely perceptible, a low, dissonant hum. I stood up and looked around. What was this noise? I picked up my pack and proceeded east. Because of the crunching sound created by my footsteps on the fallen leaves, I had to stop and listen very intensely to still hear the hum. But it was there. Ahead, the woods ended, and I entered a large meadow, colorful with wildflowers and thick 2-foot-tall sage grass that seemed to go on for half a mile. The breeze brushed the tops of the sage in currents. When I had almost reached the edge of the meadow, I noticed a patch of blackberry brambles growing beside a fallen tree. The bushes struck me as exceedingly beautiful, and I walked over to look at them more closely, imagining that they were full of berries. As I did this, I experienced an intense feeling of deja vu. In the back of my mind rose a picture of a crystal-clear pool of water and several tiers of waterfalls in the background, a location that, as I imaged it, seemed equally familiar. Again, I felt anxious. Without warning, an animal of some kind ran noisily from the berry patch, startling me, and headed north for about 20 feet, and then abruptly stopped. The creature was hidden in the tall sage, and I had no idea what it was, but I could follow its wake in the grass. After a few minutes, it darted back a few feet to the south, remained motionless again for several seconds, then darted 10 or 20 feet back again toward the north, only to stop again. I guessed it was a rabbit, although its movements seemed especially peculiar. For 5 or 6 minutes, I watched the area where the animal had last moved, then slowly walked that way. As I closed to about 5 feet, it suddenly sped away again toward the north. At one point, before it disappeared into the distance, I glimpsed the white tail and hind legs of a large rabbit. I smiled and proceeded east again along the trail, coming finally to the end of the meadow, where I entered an area of thick woods. To my surprise, I ran into the trail the rabbit had made in the sage, and followed its path until I caught sight of the small creek again. Here the dense undergrowth receded, partially, allowing me to push my way through into an area of larger old-growth trees, where I could follow the creek, due north. After proceeding for what I judged to be about another mile, I could see a range of foothills rising in the distance on both sides of the creek. Walking further, I realized that these hills were forming steep canyon walls, and that up ahead was what looked to be the only entrance. When I arrived, I sat down beside a large hickory and surveyed the scene. 100 yards on both sides of the creek, the hills butted off in 50-foot-high limestone bluffs, then bent outward into the distance, forming a huge bowl-like canyon, perhaps 2 miles wide and at least 4 miles long. In my reverie, I again saw the pool and waterfall in my mind's eye, only this time I seemed to be there, walking up as if to greet someone. I shook the picture from my head. What was happening? These images were growing more vivid. First, David and another time, now these falls. Movement in the canyon caught my eye. I glanced at the creek, and then beyond to a lone tree 200 yards away, which had already lost most of its leaves. It was now covered with what looked like large crows. Several flew down to the ground. It came to me that these were the same crows I had heard earlier. As I watched, they suddenly all flew and dramatically circled above the tree. I walked toward the tree. Immediately, the image of the pool and waterfalls flashed across my mind. This time, I tried to remember the entire picture. The pool I saw was large, almost an acre. The water flowing into it came in from the rear, cascading down a series of steep terraces. Two smaller falls each dropped only about 15 feet, but the last dropped over a long 30-foot bluff into the pool. Again, in the image that came to mind, I seemed to be walking up to the scene, meeting someone. The sound of a vehicle to my left stopped me firmly in my tracks. I kneeled down between several small bushes. From the forest on the left, a gray jeep moved across the meadow, heading southeast. I expected to see a Forest Service insignia on the jeep's door, but to my surprise, it was unmarked. When it was directly in front of me, 50 yards away, the vehicle stopped. Through the foliage, I could make out a lone figure inside. He was surveying the area with field glasses, so I laid flat and hid myself completely. I knew that Forest Service policy prohibited private vehicles this far into the wilderness. Who were these people? The vehicle started up again and quickly vanished out of sight in the trees. I thought about returning to town, but finding another way to search for Charlene. But deep inside, I knew there was no alternative. I shut my eyes and thought again of David's instruction to maintain my intuitions and finally retrieve the full image of the pool and falls in my mind's eye. As I got to my feet and headed again toward the crow tree, I tried to keep the details of the scene in the back of my mind. Suddenly, I heard the shrill cry of another bird, this time a hawk. To my left, far past the tree, I could barely make out her shape. She was streaking hard toward the north. I increased my pace, trying to keep the bird in sight for as long as possible. The bird's appearance seemed to increase my energy, and even after she had disappeared over the horizon, I kept moving in the direction she had been flying, walking for another mile and a half over a series of rocky foothills. At the top of the third hill, I froze again, hearing another sound in the distance, a sound much like water running. No, it was water falling. I climbed the next hill, and there, beyond the crest, was the pool and falls exactly as I had pictured them, except that the area was much larger and more beautiful than I had pictured. The pool itself was almost 2 acres and nestled in a cradle of enormous boulders and outcroppings, its crystal clear water a sparkling blue in the afternoon sky. To the left and right of the pool were several large oak trees, themselves surrounded by a multicolored array of smaller maples and sweet gums and willows. The far edge of the pool was an explosion of white spray and mist, the foam accentuated by the churning action of the two smaller falls higher up the ridge. I realized there was no runoff from the pool. The water went underground from here, traveling silently to emerge as the source of the large spring near the crow tree. I moved down to the pool, and then walked around the entire area, to the edge to taste the water, up the cascades to feel the spray from each of the falls, over atop the large boulders where I could touch the trees. I wanted to immerse myself in the place. Finally, I stretched out on one of the flatter rocks 20 feet above the pool and looked toward the afternoon sun with my eyes closed, feeling its rays against my face. In that moment, another familiar sensation swept across my body, a particular warmth and regard I hadn't sensed in months. In fact, until this instant, I had forgotten its exact feeling and character, although it was perfectly recognizable now. I opened my eyes and turned quickly, certain of who I was about to see. On a rock above my head, half obscured by an overhanging ledge, stood Will, his hands on his hips, smiling broadly. He appeared slightly out of focus, so I blinked hard and concentrated, and his face cleared somewhat. "I knew you would be here," he said, nimbly climbing off the ledge and jumping to the ground beside me. "I've been waiting." I looked at him in awe, and he pulled me into an embrace. His face and hands looked slightly luminescent, but otherwise seemed normal. I can't believe you're here," I stammered. "What happened when you disappeared in Peru? Where have you been?"
I'll tell you everything, he said. But first I have to know about you. What circumstances brought you to this valley? In detail, I told him about Charlene's disappearance, the map of the valley, and meeting David. Will wanted to know more of what David had said, so I told him everything I could remember about the conversation. Will leaned toward me. He told you the tenth was about understanding the spiritual renaissance on Earth in light of the other dimension and learning the true nature of your intuitions? Yes, I said. Is that right? He seemed to think for a moment, then asked, what has been your experience since entering the valley? I immediately started to see images, I said. Some were of other historical times, but then I began to see repeated visions of this pool. I saw everything, the rocks, the falls, even that someone was waiting here, although I didn't know it was you. Where were you in the scene? It was as if I was walking up and seeing it. So, it was a scene of a potential future for you. I squinted at him. I'm not sure I follow you. The first part of the tenth, as David said, is about understanding our intuitions more fully. In the first 9 insights, one experiences intuitions as fleeting gut feelings or vague hunches. But as we gain familiarity with these phenomena, we can now grasp the nature of these intuitions more clearly. Think back to Peru. Didn't intuitions come to you as pictures of what was going to happen? Images of yourself and others at a specific location, doing certain things, leading you to go there? Wasn't that how you knew when to go to the Celestine ruins? Here in the valley, the same thing has been happening. You received a mental image of a potential event, finding the falls and meeting someone, and you were able to live it out, bringing on the coincidence of actually discovering the location and encountering me. If you had shrugged off the image or lost faith in looking for the falls, you would have missed the synchronicity, and your life would have stayed flat. But you took the image seriously. You kept it in your mind. Well, what about the other images, I asked, the scenes of an earlier time? And what about these animals? Does the tenth insight talk about all this? Have you seen the manuscript? With a gesture of his hand, Will waved off my question. First, let me tell you about my experience in the other dimension, what I call the afterlife dimension. When I was able to maintain my energy level in Peru, he began, even when the rest of you grew fearful and lost your vibration, I found myself in an incredible world of beauty and clear form. I was right there, in the same place, but everything was different. The world was luminous and awing in a way I still can't describe. For a long time, I just walked around in this incredible world, vibrating even higher. And then I discovered something quite amazing. I could will myself anywhere on the planet just by imaging a destination in my mind. I traveled everywhere I could think of, looking for you and Julia and the others, but I couldn't find any of you. What happened then? I asked. I focused within, looking for a higher connection with divine energy, just the way we've always done it. That's all it took. My vibration rose even higher, and I began to receive intuitions again. I saw an image of you. What was I doing? I couldn't tell. The image was hazy. But when I thought about the intuition and maintained it in my mind, I began to move into a new area of the afterlife where I could actually see other souls. Groups of souls, really, and while I couldn't exactly speak to them, I could vaguely pick up on their thoughts and knowledge. Were they able to show you the tenth insight? I asked. He swallowed hard and looked at me as though he was about to land a bombshell. No, the tenth insight has never been written down. What? It's not part of the original manuscript?
No.
Does it even exist? Oh, yes, it exists, but not in the earthly dimension. This insight hasn't made it to the physical plane yet. This knowledge exists only in the afterlife. Only when enough people on Earth sense this information intuitively can it become real enough in everyone's consciousness for someone to write it down. That's what happened with the first 9 insights. In fact, that's what has happened with all spiritual texts, even our most sacred scriptures. Always it is information that first exists in the afterlife and is finally picked up clearly enough in the physical dimension to be manifested by someone who is supposed to write it down. That's why these writings are called divinely inspired. So why has it taken so long for someone to grasp the tenth, I asked. Will looked perplexed. I don't know. The soul group I was communicating with seemed to know, but I couldn't quite understand. My energy level was not high enough. It has something to do with the fear that arises in a culture that is moving from a material reality to a transformed, spiritual worldview.
Then you think the tenth is ready to come in?
Yes. The soul group saw the tenth coming in now, bit by bit, all over the world, as we gain a higher perspective that comes from a knowledge of the afterlife. But it has to be grasped in sufficient numbers, just as with the first 9, in order to overcome the fear.
Do you know what the rest of the tenth is about?
Yes. Apparently just knowing the first 9 isn't enough. We have to understand how we will implement this destiny. Such knowledge comes from grasping the special relationship between the physical dimension and the afterlife. We have to understand the birth process, where we came from, the larger picture of what human history is trying to accomplish. A thought suddenly came to me.
Wait a minute. Weren't you able to see a copy of the 9th insight?
What did it say about the 10th?
Will leaned toward me. It said that the first 9 insights had described the reality of spiritual evolution, both personally and collectively, but actually implementing these insights, living them, and fulfilling this destiny requires a fuller understanding of the process, a 10th insight. This insight would show us the reality of the Earth's spiritual transformation, not just from the perspective of the earthly dimension, but from the perspective of the afterlife dimension as well. It said we would understand more fully why we were uniting the dimensions, why humans must fulfill this historical purpose, and it would be this understanding, once integrated into culture, that would ensure this eventual outcome. It also mentioned the fear, saying that at the same time a new spiritual awareness was emerging, a reactive polarization would also rise up in fearful opposition, seeking to willfully control the future with various new technologies, technologies even more dangerous than the nuclear menace that are already being discovered. The 10th insight resolves this polarization.
He stopped abruptly and nodded toward the east.
Do you hear that?
I listened, but I could hear only the falls.
What?
I asked.
That hum.
I heard it earlier. What is it?
I'm not sure exactly, but it can be heard in the other dimension as well. The souls I saw seemed very disturbed about it.
As Will spoke, I clearly saw Charlene's face in the back of my mind.
Do you think the hum is related to this new technology? I asked.
Will didn't answer. I noticed he had an absent look on his face.
The friend that you're looking for, he asked, does she have blonde hair and large eyes, very inquisitive looking?
Yes.
I just saw an image of her face. I stared at him.
So did I.
He turned and looked at the falls for a moment, and I followed his gaze. The white foam and spray formed a majestic background to our conversation. I could feel the energy increasing in my body.
You don't have enough energy yet, he said.
But because this place is so powerful, I think if I help, and we both focus on your friend's face, we can move fully into the spiritual dimension, and maybe find out where she is and what's happening in this valley.
Are you sure I can do that? I said.
Maybe you can go, and I can wait here for you.
His face was fading out of focus.
Will touched my lower back, giving me energy, smiling again.
Don't you see how purposeful it is that we are here? Human culture is beginning to understand the afterlife and grasp the tenth. I think we have the opportunity to explore the other dimension together. You know this feels destined. At that moment, I noticed the noise of the hum in the background, even over the sound of the falls. In fact, I could feel it in my solar plexus.
The hum's getting louder, Will said. We have to go now. Charlene could be in trouble.
What do we do? I asked. Will moved slightly closer, still touching my back.
We have to recreate the image we received of your friend.
Maintain it?
Yes. As I said, we are learning to recognize and believe in our intuitions at a higher level.
We all want the coincidences to come more consistently, but for most of us, this awareness is new, and we're surrounded by a culture that still operates too much in the old skepticism, so we lose the expectation, the faith.
Yet what we're beginning to realize is that when we fully pay attention, inspecting the details of the potential future we're shown, purposely keeping the image in the back of our minds, intentionally believing, when we do this, then whatever we are imaging tends to happen more readily.
Then we will it to happen?
No. Real fulfillment comes only when we first tune into our inner direction and divine guidance and see the intuition. Only then do we use our will to move toward the outcomes we received. In this sense, we become co-creators with the divine source. Do you see how this knowledge begins the tenth insight? We are learning to use our visualization in the same way it is used in the afterlife. And when we do, we fall into alignment with the other dimension. And that helps close the distance between heaven and earth.
I nodded. After taking several deep breaths, Will exerted more pressure on my back and instructed me to recreate the details of Charlene's face. For a moment, nothing happened. And then suddenly I felt a rush of energy, twisting me forward and pushing me into a wild acceleration.
I was streaking at fantastic speeds through a multicolored tunnel of some kind. Fully conscious, I wondered why I had no fear. For what I really felt was a sense of recognition and contentment and peace, as though I had been here before. When the movement stopped, I found myself in an environment of warm, white light. Will was standing to my left and slightly behind me.
There you are, he said, smiling at me. His lips weren't moving, but I could clearly hear his voice.
I then noticed the appearance of his body. He seemed to be completely illuminated from within. I reached over to touch his hand and noticed that my body appeared the same way. When I touched him, what I felt was a field several inches outside the arm I could see. Pushing harder, I realized I couldn't penetrate this energy. I only moved his body away from me.
Will was near bursting with mirth. In fact, his expression was so humorous that I laughed myself.
Amazing, isn't it? He asked.
This is a higher vibration than at the Celestine Ruins, I replied. Do you know where we are?
Will was silent, gazing out at our surroundings. We seemed to be in an environment that was spatial, and we had a sense of up and down, but we were suspended, motionless in midair, and there were no horizons. White light was a constant hue in all directions. Finally, Will said, This is an observation point. I came here briefly when I had imaged your face. Other souls were here.
What were they doing?
Observing people who had come over after death.
What?
You mean this is where people come right after they have died?
Yes.
Why are we here? Has something happened to Charlene?
He turned more directly toward me.
No, I don't think so. Remember what happened to me when I began to image you? I moved to many locations before we finally met at the falls.
There's probably something we need to see here before we can find Charlene. Let's wait and see what happens with these souls.
He nodded to our left, where several human-like entities were materializing directly in front of us, at a distance of what appeared to be about 30 feet. As the entities formed completely, I remained cautious, but eventually I felt a loving and supportive energy emanating from their bodies, which seemed to be comprised of a whitish amber light that danced and shimmered in and out of focus. Their faces had human characteristics, but could not be looked at directly. I couldn't even tell how many souls were there. At one moment, three or four seemed to be facing us. Then I would blink, and there would be six. Then three again, all dancing, in and out of view. Overall, they looked like a flickering, animated cloud of amber against the background color of white. After several minutes, another form began to materialize beside the others. Only this figure was more clearly in focus and appeared in a luminous body similar to Will and myself. We could see that it was a middle-aged man. He looked around wildly, then saw the group of souls and began to relax. To my surprise, when I focused closely on him, I could pick up on what he was feeling and thinking. I glanced at Will, who nodded that he was also sensing the person's reaction. I focused again and observed that, in spite of a certain detachment and a sense of love and support, he was in a state of shock at having discovered he had died. Only minutes before, he had been routinely jogging, and while attempting to run up a long hill, had suffered a massive heart attack. The pain had lasted only a few seconds, and then, suddenly, he was hovering outside his body, watching a stream of bystanders rush up to help him. He had called out for help, and had instantly found himself in a tunnel of colors that had brought him to where he now stood. As we watched, he seemed to become more aware of the souls and moved toward them, shifting out of focus to us, appearing more like them. Then, abruptly, he pulled back toward us and was quickly surrounded by an office of some kind, filled with computers and wall charts and people working. Everything looked perfectly real, except the walls were semi-transparent so that we could see what was happening inside, and the sky above the office was not blue, but a strange olive color. "He's deluding himself," Will said. "He's recreating the office where he worked on Earth, trying to pretend he hasn't died." The entities moved closer, and others came until there were dozens of them, all flickering in and out of focus in the amber light. They seemed to be sending the man love and some kind of information I couldn't understand. Gradually, the constructed office began to fade and eventually disappeared completely. The man was left with an expression of resignation on his face, and he again moved into focus with the entities. "Let's go with them," I heard Will say. At the same moment, I felt his arm, or rather the energy of his arm, pushing against my back. As soon as I inwardly agreed, there was the slight sensation of movement, and the entities and the man all came into clearer focus. The entities now had glowing faces, much like Will and I, but their hands and feet, instead of being clearly formed, were mere radiations of light. I could now focus on the entities for as long as 4 or 5 seconds before losing them and having to blink to find them again. I became aware that the group of souls, as well as the deceased individual, were watching an intense point of bright light moving toward us. It eventually swelled into a massive beam that covered everything. Unable to look directly at the light, I turned so I could just see the silhouette of the man, who was staring fully at the beam without apparent difficulty. Again, I could pick up on his thoughts and emotions. The light was filling him with an unimaginable sense of love and calm perspective. As this sensation swept over him, his viewpoint and knowledge expanded until he could clearly see the life he had just lived from a broad and amazingly detailed perspective. Immediately, he could see the circumstances of his birth and early family life. He was born John Donald Williams, to a father who was slow intellectually and to a mother who was extremely detached and absent because of her involvement in various social events. As a result, he had grown up angry and defiant, an interrogator, eager to prove to the world that he was a brilliant achiever that could master science and mathematics. He earned a doctorate in physics at MIT at 23 and taught at 4 prestigious universities before moving on to the Defense Department and later to a private energy corporation. Clearly, he had thrown himself into this later position with total abandon and disregard for his health. After years of fast foods and no exercise, he was diagnosed with a chronic heart condition. an exercise routine pursued too aggressively, it proved fatal. He died in his prime at age 58. At this point, William's awareness shifted, and he began to have profound regrets and severe emotional pain concerning the way he had led his life. He realized that his childhood and early family had been set up perfectly to expose what was already his soul's tendency to use defiance and elitism to feel more important. His main tool had been ridicule, putting down others by criticizing their abilities and work ethics and personality. Yet now he could see that all the teachers had been in place to help him overcome this insecurity. All of them had arrived at just the right time to show him another way, but he had ignored them completely. Instead, he had just pursued his tunnel vision to the end. All the signs had been there to choose his work more carefully, to slow down. There were a multitude of implications and dangers inherent in his research that he had failed to consider. He had allowed his employers to feed him new theories and even unfamiliar physical principles without even questioning their origin. These procedures worked, and that was all he cared about, because they led to success, gratitude, recognition. He had succumbed to his need for recognition. Again. My God, he thought, I failed just as I did before. His mind abruptly shifted to a new scene, an earlier existence. He was in the southern Appalachians. It was the 19th century, a military outpost. In a large tent, several men leaned over a map. Lanterns flickered their light against the walls. A consensus had been reached among all the field officers present. There was no hope for peace now. War was inevitable, and sound military principles dictated an attack quickly. As one of the commanding general's top two aides, Williams had been forced to concur with the others. No other choice existed, he had concluded. Disagreement would have ended his career. Besides, he couldn't have dissuaded the others even if he had wanted to. The offensive would have to be carried out, likely the last major battle in the Eastern War against the natives. A sentry interrupted with a communication for the general. A settler wanted to see the commander immediately. Looking through the open tent flap, Williams had seen the frail white woman, perhaps 30, desperation in her eyes. He found out later that she was the daughter of a missionary, bringing word of a possible new Native American initiative for peace, an appeal that she personally had negotiated at great risk. But the general had refused to see her, remaining in the tent as she shouted at him, finally ordering her from his camp at gunpoint, not knowing the content of her message, not wanting to know. Again, Williams kept quiet. Williams knew that a war would greatly please the railroad and coal tycoons and the newly emerging oil interests, and would, of course, ensure his own future as well. All he had to do was to keep his mouth shut and play along. And he would, under silent protest, unlike the general's other primary aide. He remembered looking across the room at his colleague, a small man who limped slightly. This man, like the general and other controllers, feared the Native Americans and wanted them removed, not just because of their ferocity at war or the strength of their numbers, not even because of their alienation to the expanding industrial economy that was poised to overrun their lands. They feared the natives because of something deeper, some terrifying and transformative idea, known in its entirety only by a few elders, but which bubbled up through their culture and called out for the controllers to change, to remember another vision. As we watched, William's recollection shifted to a gorge in the deep woods, site of the coming battle. Cavalry poured over a ridge in a surprise offensive. The Native Americans rose to the defense, ambushing the cavalry from the bluffs on either side. A short distance away, a large man and a woman huddled among the rocks. The man was a young academic, an observer of some kind, terrified he was this close to a battle. It was wrong, all wrong. His interest was economics. He knew nothing of violence. The woman beside him in the rocks was the young missionary seen at the military tent earlier. At this moment, she felt abandoned, betrayed. Her effort could have worked, she knew, if those with the power had listened to what was possible. But she would not give up, she had told herself, not until the violence stopped. She kept saying, it can be healed, it can be healed. Suddenly, on the downslope behind them, two cavalrymen rode hard toward a single native chief. I strained to see who it was, finally recognizing the man as the angry chief who had been so vocal against the white woman's ideas. As I watched, he turned quickly and shot an arrow into the chest of one of his pursuers. The other soldier leaped from his horse and fell upon the Native American. Both struggled furiously, the soldier's knife finally plunging deep into the throat of the darker man. Blood gushed across the torn ground.